Hey, fellow nerds. I'm Megan Smiley, and this is the Lawyer's Escape Pod. For those of you who've gotten into practice, looked around, and thought, so this is my life? I get it. You're in deep, and you feel stuck. You may have no idea what the next step would be, or maybe you have an idea, but think it's unrealistic. I truly believe that there's a path forward for each of us if we're intentional about finding it. And this podcast will be a great source of advice and inspiration for you to make that leap to a more fulfilling career. My guest today is Heather Hubbard. She's a former intellectual property and entertainment lawyer who practiced for 10 years before being drawn by her unique talents into starting her own personal and professional development company. She tells us about her journey out of practice, the limits we place on ourselves as lawyers, and particularly how that plays into the legal profession and the norms that we've all set for ourselves there. And she gives us some tools that we can leverage to help move ourselves forward, both in our careers and in our thinking. So I think that this episode has a lot of really good advice, and I think you'll be excited to listen. Separately, I also just wanted to check in on the challenge to see if everyone had picked something to do this summer to move themselves forward. I know I said I was also thinking about it, and I am. I actually have some pretty exciting stuff I am working on. Not quite ready to announce it here, but I will be soon. But if you come and find me on Instagram, I'm probably going to be posting a little bit about that there in advance. So come say hi. Come tell me what you're working on. I really would love to hear from everybody. So, all right, that said, let's move on to my conversation with Heather. Hi, Heather. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Megan. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. So I'd like to start with all of my guests and get a little background on what got you into law in the first place.
Well, I was in the third grade. And yeah, it goes back that far. I was in the third grade and my teacher, Miss Penny Whitaker, she had us do this lesson on firsts. Amelia Earhart, Neil Armstrong, and she asked us to draw our foot and what we were going to be the first of. And I said, well, clearly I'm going to be the first woman president. Which
obviously.
I guess technically
it's still on the
possible table.
And
so I go home to my dad very seriously. And I'm like, okay, Dad, I've decided I want to be the first woman president. What should I do to accomplish that? And so he says, well, you should probably become an attorney. And I said, got it. No problem. I asked for a briefcase for Christmas and the rest.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. So you were just sort of off to the races with it from a very young age.
Yeah. And I never really changed my mind on that, which is, I don't know, a little scary, a little comical, but yeah, I always had a love for arts and creativity and that kind of thing. So I was a singer and dancer and did theater. So what I ended up doing, I was an intern in college for our state government and quickly realized I had no desire to be in politics. But so I married the love of, I really love the rule of law and power and influence with the creative side. So I practiced entertainment and intellectual property law.
Ah, that brings it together. Yeah. So did you enjoy law school, that sort of process? It didn't put you off, even though you had sort of had to recalibrate your long-term goal?
I loved law school. I have to say, I didn't know any lawyers growing up. I interned for one in high school, but I didn't know him. I literally like wrote him a cold letter that said, hey, there were two attorneys in town. I'm from a tiny town. And said,
where are you from?
Berea. Well, I was living in Berea, Kentucky at the time. And I literally just wrote them letters and was like, hey, can I come work for you? And the one was like, no. And the other was super nice. And so I worked with him for 2 years. But so, I didn't grow up with money. I wasn't in that world. And so when I went to law school, and Vanderbilt had just remodeled. So I know that sounds silly, but like there was this beautiful building and I was surrounded by all these really smart, brilliant people. And so I just loved it. I soaked it in because I just felt like such an accomplishment.
Yeah. And it was, so did you get straight into entertainment law right out of law school?
Yes. So I knew that that's what I wanted to do when I went in to law school. So And I'm always, I mean, I've always kind of been a business person in the sense that like I'm constantly positioning. And so when I went in, it wasn't just let's get through law school. It was, and how are we going to become an entertainment and IP attorney when everyone was saying that's a really hard area to get into. You can't do that. So my first year in law school, I mean, I was already, I was working within the entertainment industry. I was going to the Entertainment Law Society. I was paying to go to their bar association meetings and their CLEs. And I was already networking and meeting with attorneys because I knew that's what I wanted to do. And it worked.
Yeah. It's funny. I work at a law school now, and this is what we're always telling the students is if you want to get a job that's hard to get, that's the type of thing you have to be doing right from the get-go. So,
yes.
So it worked. You got a job in that field.
I did. Yes.
And how long did you practice in that area?
So I was with a boutique firm at first, because none of the big firms really had that area. Well, that one. Two, I didn't have the grades to even qualify for interviews with them. And three, it was mostly IP, not entertainment. So I was with a boutique firm for 2 years, and then I lateraled over to one of those big firms who I didn't qualify to interview for, and eventually became a partner and practice group leader there. But so I practiced, I practiced that area of law for, I'm trying to think, I guess it was over 10 years before I then left. Yeah.
And what was your experience practicing? I mean, 10 years is a significant number of years to be practicing. And did you, where in the process did you start to think this isn't actually where I should be?
So I loved being a lawyer, and technically I'm still licensed. But I mean, I really, really enjoyed it. I loved it. I mean, don't get me wrong. There were plenty of days that I did not enjoy, but I loved practicing law. But I decided to exit out really when I was in that management position. And I found myself advocating for so many women and, you know, attorneys of color. And I was often the only female in the room. And even with compensation meetings, I just started to notice that a lot of women and attorneys of color, they weren't positioning themselves the way that the white men were. And I was doing the white man approach, but didn't even realize it. Like it's just more assertive and direct. And I also saw that I could help a lot of people within my firm. But it occurred to me I could help a whole lot more people if I exited out and started my own company. To that point, I didn't really realize at that point that I did things differently. I just thought I was a hard worker and I was strategic. I didn't fully appreciate that that was maybe one of my gifts and a zone of genius for me was being really strategic and assertive. And so that's when I thought it would possibly be even more fun to be helping others if I had my own company. And again, it goes back to that I also didn't realize how business minded I am. And so the thought of being an entrepreneur just really excited me.
Yeah. So how did you make that transition then?
Oh, I just did it. So lots of people ask, they're like, what was your plan? What was your note? So I started considering making some kind of move. I didn't know what it would look like in February of 2014. In July of 2014, I told my firm, I'm thinking of making some kind of transition. I don't think they believed me. And then in October, I said, okay, 2 weeks notice, I'm going to go start my own company. And everybody was like, what? I was like, I told you I was thinking of something. And so I just did the thing. Like, I just did it. And I didn't really, I'm a planner, but I did not have a plan in place, partly because I knew that if I thought too much about it, if I tried to get it perfect, I would never take action. And so I knew if I just took the leap, either I would fly or I would fail. And I know me and my personality, and it was going to force me to fly. So
right.
I took the leap.
Wow. So what, there was no part of you, you said that you're still licensed. Do you still practice? Was that something that you continued to do, maybe not full time, but on the side, or did you fully leave that?
No. So I started the company. My firm did not want me to leave. So there were a few matters where we agreed I would be a contract attorney, but, you know, it was all going to be virtual and through basically my own firm. And I had a few clients that I took with me that I did on the side for the first year just to help with income. But it was not, it was very little. And by the second year, I was taking no new clients. And by the third year, I had completely shut it down. So, I mean, I guess I practice in the sense that, like, I use, I'm my company's lawyer. but otherwise, the reason why, I know every state's different, but in Tennessee, which is where I live, and that's where I'm licensed, to go on inactive status, you still have to pay a bit of money, right? And you also have to get, you would have to catch up on CLE. Well, because I often provide CLE, I'm a provider now. I can teach and get my credits, so I don't have to go do other things. So it's like, naturally to me, it's like, well, if it's not, it doesn't cost that much more money, why wouldn't I stay licensed? Not to mention, I loved being a lawyer, and although I have zero intentions to go back, it just seems like a no-brainer to remain licensed if it isn't that big of a deal.
So it's interesting because I talk to a lot of people on this podcast who really struggle with the decision to leave the practice of law, but it sounds like it was a fairly straightforward one for you. Was there, was it just sort of because you felt like you weren't trying to escape something, you were just moving to sort of your higher purpose? Was that your feeling, or did you struggle with it?
You know, it's interesting because, sometimes it takes me a little bit of time to make a decision, but once I make it, I'm super decisive and I just move forward without. So when I say, you know, it didn't hold me back. I mean, the truth is maybe that was going on in my mind for years, but but if I'm, because I'm just trying to think back, I don't really think I was thinking of exiting out for me. So here's the interesting thing. Even with a lot of people I work with, their identities get wrapped up in being a lawyer. And I don't know if it's my identity never got wrapped. I mean, to me, I am a lawyer. I will always be a lawyer. Whether I'm practicing or not, that doesn't, it's a part of who I am. And that can't be taken away from me. So, you know, to me, it was, I guess what you're saying, like, it's really just a building block. Like, it's not like that part of me died, but so many people do grieve that and struggle with that concept. To me, it's like, it's not like I put it to the side. It's, I just brought it with me.
Right, right. And you were excited about what you were going on to do. Because I think that what a lot of people struggle with is they are just, their starting point is that they're miserable practicing. And then, and then they're like, oh, what else am I going to do? And it, you know, it's a big search. Whereas for you, you were, you know, Lucky also just sounds like you're someone who's very in tune with what works for her, that it wasn't that kind of struggle for you.
Right. Yes. That's very perceptive. Yes.
So when you moved on to start your own firm, what does that look like for you? What exactly do you do in this new role?
So yeah, with my new company, I am, it's a personal and professional development company. And the main thing that I focus on is high level masterminds, but I also have a podcast. And so I give a ton of free value there. I have a planner and a planning system. And we're constantly, we've got a few different things that are always coming in and out based on what my ideal clients are wanting at the time and what really jazzes me up, because I'm all about, like, if it's not fun, what's the point? So workshops and things like that, but it's mostly around, it's, you know, it's mostly around strategy with helping people grow their businesses or rise within their careers. So I'm generally working with pretty successful people. I think what makes me a little bit different is that I take a very holistic view. So that's where it starts to look a little bit like personal development, because there's a lot related to mindset, and taking care of yourself that comes into play. You can't be super successful, and have a super successful business if you're not doing those things. Well, I guess you could, but then it's not satisfying. And again, what's the point?
Right. And you don't exclusively work with lawyers, but I assume you do work with lawyers quite frequently.
The vast majority of my clients are lawyers because that's my background. That's my network. Right. People know me. But yes, I do work with more than just lawyers, but most of them do tend to be service-based professionals. Mm-hmm. Either that was their background and they started their own coaching and consulting company, or they're in a large firm, whether they're an accountant, they might be a doctor, something like that. But it really is that more, they tend to have that professional background or more entrepreneurial background.
Yeah. So in working with lawyers, what are some of the common, you referred to sort of mindset issues or other challenges lawyers have in sort of advancing their careers? If that is, I take it that some of your clients stay within practice, some of them are looking to leave, but what do you find are some of the challenges that lawyers tend to face in thinking through career planning?
Yeah, so lawyers get stuck in their heads like no one I have ever met.
Yep.
I mean, the mental gymnastics that go on are...
I know, we make it so hard on ourselves.
So, you know, I've heard some people say, you know, law school does that to people, that they weren't like that before law school. My guess is maybe there was a tendency and then it just got worse. But this constant, I have to get things perfect. I have to get things right. And if I make the wrong mistake, I will never be able to come back from it. Like if I make the wrong decision, it will be the end of the world. And I have to please everyone and I have to show up in a certain way and I have to have it all together all of the time. And I'm constantly looking at what's going to go wrong. What are the risks? And everything's black and white. So there's no gray. There's no, what can I learn from this? Or how might this apply to me? It's yes and no. And that kind of thinking, one, causes you to totally overanalyze everything and get stuck in your head. But two, I think that that's what causes so much of the mental health problems in the legal industry.
Yeah. I mean, that makes sense. And it feels so familiar because, you know, for those of us who have been lawyers, it's something I think we all struggle with on different levels, right? And I just can't say how much that resonates to hear that. And it's, you know, we have to battle with it. So if someone sort of you're working with comes in with all of those challenges, how do you work with someone who's sort of uphill battling their own mentality towards, you know, feeling like you can't make a step if you're fearful that it's going to be the wrong thing?
Right. So, you know, and I used to be in this space of, you know, I kind of think the legal industry has brainwashed us in a way. And it just seems like there's all this gaslighting around. We can only do this one thing. And if we don't do it in this one way or this one path, like we are a nobody, we are not enough, we are going to end up homeless under a bridge. And I struggled with that, I think, for a long time, too, in the sense that I thought things had to be done a certain way. Yeah, I had very black and white thinking. I was not, you know, as positive and optimistic. And so for me, I was able to finally break free from that when I got some time and space, and it really is perspective. And what worked for me in gaining perspective was mindfulness. And for others, it looks a little different. So some people need to do thought work. Some people need to do mindfulness. Some people need to do meditation. But I can tell you this, if you are stuck in the place of, I don't have options, if you are stuck in the place of, well, that's great, that works for you, won't work for me, you're going to get more of that. Like you're going to get more of that. If you think you can't, you are going to prove yourself right every single day of the week. So unless and until someone is willing to believe that there is another way, I generally will tell them I cannot help them.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think there has to at least be a window of open-mindedness to how to change your thought process. So you mentioned both mindfulness and how you structure your thoughts. Yeah. Could you talk to us a little bit more about what you mean by those things?
Yeah. So to me, mindfulness really is, you know, it's it goes back thousands of years. It really is, you know, an Eastern philosophy that we Westerners have just started to adopt. And Jon Kabat-Zinn out of Massachusetts is really kind of considered the leader of that, at least here in the U.S. And that started in, I believe it was about the 80s. But it's the concept of being able to realize that you are not your body and you are not your mind. And so it's being able to see that you are actually something else. And this is going to sound weird, but it's like you can rise up and start to witness your thoughts. You can rise up and start to witness everything that's going on in your body and your mind constantly. And for most of us, it's a lot of chatter. And so being able to create space, being able to pay attention to just one thing at a time on purpose, and choosing to respond instead of react. And there's a ton of resources out there on mindfulness and how to get started in that practice. That's really what that's about. Thought work is newer. It's more behavioral science. That is not what I did, but I know a lot of people who like it and do it. So some people who do kind of thought work type stuff would be Carl Lowenthal, Brooke Castillo, more of that work. For me, mine was really more mindfulness and quite frankly, also some 12-step principles. I had a family member who was an addict. And so that's where I learned to step back and have perspective. It was even, so I hadn't taken a vacation, a true vacation, not even a single true day off in over a decade. Because I thought,
I mean, that's insane.
I thought I was supposed to always be on call. So, and the people I worked with indeed also thought I should always be on call. So I was always answering emails and phone calls, whatever. I mean, that doesn't mean I didn't ever take a break, but I was always connected. And when you were connected in the rat race, you can't see the truth. And so I finally took a 10-day fully unplugged vacation. And that is what then, and it was during that time and space window, I got perspective and realized that I had let my mind completely hijack every part of my life. And once I realized it didn't have control over me, and I saw that law didn't have control over me, my employers, my partners didn't have control over me, my clients didn't have control over me, I then had space to say, well, if I was in control of me, what would I do? And that's what changed everything, not just in the way I was able to manage my stress and anxiety while practicing and have more growth-minded, you know, gray thinking as opposed to black and white thinking, but it's what gave me permission to look at those stories and those fears that the law, the legal industry tells us and say, you know what, I don't actually think any of that's true. And what if I go test it out and see if they're wrong? And what I found out was they are 100% wrong.
I think it is so hard for lawyers for a variety of reasons. The things you said as well, you know, it's a little bit our personalities probably to start with. It is what we learn in law school. And I also think it's that by and large, we start fairly young and it is often the only real job people have had. And they get into it and they have zero perspective that not everybody's work life looks like this. And there's just doesn't feel like there's a road out. And like you said, if you go 10 years without a full day off, you're not giving yourself the time and space to even consider that there's a different way to approach your career.
Right. Well, and we tell ourselves we're special. I mean, I used to, and I hear lawyers all the time, well, people don't understand me. People don't understand lawyers. People don't get lawyers. It's like, no, I think people do. And it's probably accurate. It's just that you've bought into a story that is limiting you and you can keep it or you can let it go. And that decision is really all yours.
Yeah. Do you feel like you notice a difference of lawyers being more open to these kind of, you know, perspective shifts and doing some of the mindfulness work? You know, I feel like I'm talking about it now in a way that I certainly wasn't a decade ago when I was thinking about leaving the law. It feels like there is a growing support network for lawyers in this way. Is that sort of your sense as well?
Absolutely. I mean, and I don't think it's just with lawyers. I think we have become a society that is so burnt out. Really with the advent of the smartphone, right? We had the computer and then we had the smartphone. And so everyone's connected all the time. And part of the reason why lawyers feel like they have to work 24/7 is because their clients, their companies, they're also doing the same thing. And so I think we've got a major mental health crisis going on across the country, not just with lawyers. And I think people are starting to say, wait, I'm not okay with this. And I think we have more and more, I think it's mostly women, although I think we do have some men who are starting to question, is there a better way? Does it have to be done this way? I know that's what I've always been told.
Right.
But is that true? And so what I see is a lot of attorneys who are really being open to new ideas. They're being innovative. They are looking for new and better ways to do things in and outside the law. And then there are plenty who are 100%, you know, tied to that old, you know, masculine patriarchal way of doing things. And that's fine. They can keep it, right? Like, we don't have to persuade them to change. But I think there's a huge uprising of people who are pushing the boundaries and doing things different. And I think over time, even in the next decade or two, we're going to see a lot of change. And not that like the old paradigm is going to like crumble and fall. It's just I think there's going to be a new economy that really is growing, and you get to pick which one you want to be in.
I believe that. I also think that, you know, as the generations move forward, you know, so I come from a family of lawyers. My dad was a lawyer. In a world where you signed up for a firm right out of law school, and then you spent 35 to 40 years there, and then you retire. Yeah. And I feel like I'm sort of in, you know, I left the practice 10 years ago, and I certainly have classmates who are on that kind of old school path. Yep. But there's mixing in the millennial sort of, I don't know, sort of composite career, the idea that you don't stay in a job forever, I do think is seeping into the legal world. And I, you know, I think those big law firm structures will last, but I do think that there are going to be opportunities to create, whether it's practicing law or it's that you leave law, just it's going to look different if you make the effort to make it look different for yourself, right? You have to start with, what do I want?
Exactly. Yeah. Yep.
So who do you, you said sort of being open to these conversations is an important prerequisite to working with you in a way that would be helpful. Are there other things that people you'd recommend saying, this is a good candidate for working with a coach or working in the mastermind, things that would help people make the most of an experience like that?
I mean, I think anyone is a good candidate to work with a coach or a therapist for that matter. And by the way, so it's funny, I don't really see myself as a coach, but most of my clients do, because I don't really do, it's hard to always put me in a box, but so that's how they describe me. But coaches who go get certified, and the coaching industry in general, typically it's about helping pull things out of you, helping you see a new perspective, kind of like with a therapist, right? Where they're really opening up dialogue, which is a fabulous thing. I've had coaches, I've had therapists. I think both are fabulous. For me personally, I'm just going to give you my advice and tell you what I think. So I'm not really a coach. I'm probably more like, you know, a true sports coach or something where it's like, okay, look, where's your strategy and here's what you're doing. But so I think anyone can benefit from that. Even if you're like, I'm not even open to a new idea, but I'm at a breaking point. Go see if they can't help pull that opening out for you. Right.
Right.
But I think you're going to be able to get the best results, especially out of a mastermind. When you know that you want something so bad that you're willing to put in the work to get the results. Right. And that's where I think a lot of people get tripped up, because they know they want to change, but they don't actually want to do the things required to get the change.
Yeah.
And that is not a good candidate to work with me. Well, one, I don't have patience. Yeah. And two, I am super competitive, which means I am super results focused. So to me, if I don't think I can get you results, and I can't, if you're not actually willing to put in the work, then I would prefer you go work with someone else. So it's just because that's the thing, right? Like, and we all have areas of our life where like we want the change, we want the results, but we're not willing to put in the work, myself included. I just always encourage people, if that's where you are with the thing, it's more important to let it go.
Yeah.
It's more important to work on surrender than it is to change the thing, because you're going to keep setting yourself up for failure and then you're going to beat yourself up even more. And like, that's not helpful.
Right. Right. Yeah. And when you're ready, like you said, when you hit that breaking point, you may truly be open to doing the work that you might not have been done in, you know, timing is everything, something that you'd be willing to do next year. You just might not be there this year, and that's okay.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Just to jump back a little bit, you mentioned the mastermind, and I sort of was like, yep. But I'm not sure everybody maybe knows exactly what that structure looks like. Can you tell us what that looks like when you work in a mastermind?
Yeah. And I have to say, so it's always funny, right? Masterminds are becoming more and more popular, and people are using that term in different ways.
Yeah.
So I will share what I believe a mastermind is.
Yeah.
But it really comes from like the term. It was first coined by Napoleon Hill in a book called Think and Grow Rich. And it was based on Andrew Carnegie, and or Carnegie, however you want to say it.
Might be wrong.
Me too, but so it's this concept that he would get together with, of course, they were all white dudes, but they would all get together and they would become what was a mastermind, which meant, you know, it's basically we can do more together than we can alone. But not just from like a connection of resources, that's part of it. But the other is when you've got brilliant minds at the same table, you can really elevate what you're doing if you collaborate and give each other advice. And so it's kind of like, if you think about a company, it can be like a board of advisors. So a true mastermind in my mind is an opportunity where people are coming together, like-minded people are coming together, and they really do provide for each other very, very strategic feedback on where they are. So sometimes masterminds can look a bit like group coaching. Depending on the level of mastermind, it might have a very specific theme, and it may not. So for the high-end mastermind that that I run, it is limited to women. Most are already really successful, right? So they've been out for at least maybe 10 to 15 years. You know, a lot of them might, if they've got a book of business, it's at least at 250,000, or, you know, if they own their own company, or if they're climbing that corporate ladder, like they're already pretty high up. But they're at that point where they're like, how do I break through to the next level? How do I break that glass ceiling? How do I really take this to a half a million or a million or even more? And so I tend to attract really amazing people in my community. And so for that, I really am leading experiences, and I give them the platform and the community and the opportunity and the structure to achieve really big things. So for us, you have a really big goal that you're going after. We help break it down. We help make sure you have the resources. And then we have like expert coaching that's involved. We have these group hot seats that are involved, in-person meetings, and the whole year, the whole program is designed to help you go do that really big thing that you've either not had the time, energy, focus, mindset, or resources to do, but you really, really want to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think there's so much value in having sort of targeted support and a group of people. You know, I think when you try and do everything in a vacuum by yourself, it's so exhausting and just kind of an uphill battle. So I think having these different forms of support available, whether it's one-on-one coaching or mastermind or anything, I think I think that these are really helpful if people, I don't think that people are necessarily aware of all of these options.
Yeah.
I'm aware of them now, but I mean, 10 years ago, I would have been like, what are you talking about?
Yeah. And I think, especially because a lot of organizations try to put things together and a lot of firms put things with it internally. So you don't always know what's out there, and people don't tend to invest in themselves, right? Like, we get very, again, black and white. If my firm's not paying for it or my company's not paying for it, I'm not paying for it. As opposed to realizing you value you get to value your worth, not them.
Yeah.
But I think the beauty of whether it's group coaching or masterminds is you start to realize that you are not alone, because we think that we're the only one that like is having a certain issue, and we don't want to tell people about it. So
particularly people you work with, where the issue might be the people you work with.
right. So getting in those group settings, you start to realize, oh wait, it's not just me. And you realize, oh, wait, there's something I can do about it. So that's really the brilliance of group coaching and masterminds. And the other thing with masterminds is, well, and probably group coaching too, is confidentiality, which, right? And then even with masterminds, it's really that connection and resources and people who can help you. Like, it's almost like sponsorship, where people are supporting you in that way. Whereas for me, individual coaching, and therapy is really about, you know, you're not even ready to share it with others. You just want to share it with one other person.
Right.
And sometimes you want all the attention on a very specific refined issue. They both can have benefits, but I think they're very different benefits.
Yeah, that makes sense. And you had mentioned that you have a podcast. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So it's called Hustle and Flow, and it's all about the hustle, right, of climbing the corporate ladder or growing your own business, and then flow, because like I said, I really take a holistic view, and I learned, because I've always been a hustler. I did not always have flow, right? So flow piece is, how do you make sure that everything is aligned? How do you make sure that you are not killing yourself? How do you make sure that you are not burning out? How do you make sure that you're embracing these concepts of mindset and mindfulness and joy, and all of that? So every week we have a different topic. I alternate between just me giving some of, you know, my best advice on different topics to interviewing others. But everything has a hustle or flow theme to it. And it's really all about personal and professional growth.
Yeah. I think it's great that these are resources that are available to people, because I'm obsessed with podcasts, not just because I host one, because I listen to all of them. I just think it's such a resource that people can take advantage of. So in addition to that, are there any sort of, if someone is a lawyer and they're not happy where they are, maybe they're thinking about coaching, but just sort of, are there any other resources, whether it's books or podcasts or just general advice that you would start someone on if they were sort of asking you right now?
And I've got a question for you.
Yeah.
My advice. Would this be because they're looking for clarity around what they even want to do with their life, or because they're overwhelmed, or they're wanting to progress in their career?
Yeah, good question. I'm going to go with someone is looking for clarity. They're in a job, a practice position that they don't like, and they are not sure what it is that they would want to do moving forward, but they're unhappy where they are.
Gotcha. Okay, so I will then give a plug for one of my products. So it's because I find that a lot of times when people are looking for that clarity, they're not ready to go all in. They just want to dip their toes in the water. So I actually have an online course. You do it yourself. But it really goes through helping you decide, do I want to stay? Do I want to leave? And why am I wanting to leave anyway? Right? Like, what's the underlying issue? Because here's what I know. You are going to take your baggage with you wherever you go. So you got to be able to identify what is that baggage.
So true.
Right? What's yours and what's theirs? And then being able to explore that. So if anyone's in that position where they're like, I just really need to get a good feel for like, what's my part? What's their part? What am I wanting? What is my purpose? What is my passion? What is like opportunities? What are my strengths? All of that stuff. I do have a course called Legal Career Clarity, and it's legalcareerclarity.com. Okay. And it's a very low price point. If someone is wanting individual coaching, I often refer people to Amy Gardner. She is also from the legal space. And she was, the funny thing is back, we were both doing IP law and I was her local counsel on a matter. So it's always fun to see each other's journeys. She then, she was at Skadden, I think, as an associate, and then she went to a mid-tier firm as a partner, and then she was at the University of Chicago Law School. I think it was the Dean of Students or Dean of Admissions. Now she has her own coaching company with her husband, and she is fabulous, 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 fabulous about helping people identify what they can do with their skill set, because so many lawyers think, well, what else could I do, or what are my options? And she's great at like your resume, LinkedIn, preparing for your interview, all of that stuff. So if you're at that point where you really want to invest a little bit more, but really have that one-on-one support, I think Amy Gardner is absolutely the way to go.
All right. Well, great. And so you pointed us to the to that one online course you had, but and your podcast. But in general, if people wanted to find you, where can they go?
Yeah. So I love Instagram. It is my favorite. So that said, Instagram and Facebook, my handle for both is just Heather Joy Hubbard. And that's also my website. So heatherjoyhubbard.com.
All right. Great. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. This has been really helpful. And I think hopefully we can get a few more people into the category of ready to really work on it rather than just miserable.
we want people to be happy. I'll agree with this. So I had a coach once who asked me when I was still very much in that black and white thinking. She said, do you want to be right or do you want to be happy? And I said, I'm a lawyer. I want to be right.
Yeah.
Now I know I want to be happy. But we want happier attorneys, whether they're practicing or doing something else.
Very true. And we have a common mission in that front. So, all right. Well, thanks again, Heather. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Sure.